Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 342, recorded on January 17th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
And on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hey, Rachel.
As a reminder, our Patreon episodes are unlocked for the first several episodes. That's patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy. If you subscribe there for $5 a month, that just kind of helps us out with some of the basic costs of doing the show. We have a lot of exciting guest episodes and so forth coming up. This week, we're going to be doing just an episode of me and Rachel, however. What you're listening to now is our free episode open to everyone in our main feed, and we're going to be talking about the West Coast ports lockout of 2002. This is one of the most recent of these things that we're covering on the show, but of course 2002, quite a while ago at this point, and this is, as you'll find out, a historical incident from the time period that I think probably glided right past most people's attention. And if you weren't directly involved with it, you've probably forgotten about it. And I don't really have any recollection of it and kind of stumbled across it while looking up something else. It's a good episode to follow up with our previous free episode on the Taft-Hartley Act, as I believe it is the most recent invocation of presidential authority to end a labor dispute under the Taft-Hartley Act. If you want to hear more about that, you can go back to last week's episode. We will also be talking about, on some upcoming free episodes, about, for example, the 1934 West Coast Longshoremen's Strike and so forth. So this is a good transitional episode between a number of different things. Let's get into the history of the West Coast ports lockout of 2002. Again, this is not a strike. This is a lockout. The difference being that the employers are the ones who called it over the contract dispute, which they typically do if they want to have more leverage over the situation, pick the timing and so forth. Just generally have more control over the situation than a strike would give them if they are pretty sure that there's going to be some sort of a strike coming. There was also a specific reason that they claimed why they had called for a lockout as a means of sort of starving out the workers and forcing them to negotiate, and we'll get into that. So when did this happen and why do people not really remember it? Well, this was in October 2002, while everyone else was focused on the Iraq War Resolution, which was passed the next day. George W. Bush signed an order invoking the Taft-Hartley Act for the first time since 1971 to end a lockout of longshoremen at ports on the U.S. West Coast. Owners had refused to voluntarily reopen or give an interim contract extension because they believed workers would intentionally slow down their work without federal intervention and monitoring. The unions, primarily battling over the contract details around further automation of port work, contended that they had been working slower in response to legitimate worksite safety concerns from the deaths of five workers earlier in 2002. And interestingly, the New York Times at the time reported that the lockout was causing an estimated $10 billion in economic damage, but the union was essentially trying to win just $20 million in concessions. The order from George W. Bush, which I think also involved the son of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who, of course, returned to the Trump administration years later with various damaging things that he was doing. George W. Bush administration forced the workers to go back to work as is, instead of forcing the owners to pay out on those concessions and resolve the situation. So, Rachel, could you talk a little bit more about some of the news reports from the time on this dispute at the end of September, early October in 2002?
Yeah, there was a Money.CNN article from September 2002 talking about this this battle. So union officials deny that there was any slowdown at the ports for work to rule purposes, saying that the union was moving record amounts of cargo. There are 10,500 ILWU members working at 29 West Coast ports. And there was a statement from the ILWU International President, James Spinoza, quote, PMA's slanderous allegations of slowdowns during the biggest speed up in ILWU history that coincides with a record number of on-the-job deaths is literally adding insult to injury and making any progress toward a contract more difficult. Still, the ILWU is prepared to go back to the table and seek a negotiated settlement. And then there was an NBC News article. Also, they explained how the Taft-Hartley Act worked. So under the law, the president must appoint a board of inquiry to determine whether a work stoppage poses a national emergency. President Bush took that step on Monday, according to the article. And on Tuesday, the three-member board reported it had no confidence the two sides would resolve their dispute, quote, within a reasonable time. Administration lawyers then filed documents in U.S. District Court in San Francisco requesting a court order ending the work stoppage for an 80-day cooling-off period. Judge William Alsup issued a temporary restraining order that expired October 16th when both sides returned to court to discuss whether Alsup should impose an 80-day cooling-off period as mandated by Taft-Hartley. So over the 55 years prior to this 2002 incident, courts have granted such injunctions in 29 of 31 cases, according to the Labor Department. And also, one interesting thing to note from this article, in light of our episodes in the past talking about the clerical revolution, where paperwork rose in importance in tandem with the transportation sector during the Second Industrial Revolution, is the role of unionized white-collar clerks and blue-collar site administrators, and which makes the longshoremen a powerful union. So unionized clerks made an average of $119,000 last year, while so-called walking bosses made an average of $157,000. And about three quarters of the 10,500 union workers are at the lowest level. Longshoremen and union officials point out that many of them work only part-time or, quote, casually. Still, union leaders say wages and benefits are not an issue in the dispute. Trumka, who was the secretary of the ILWU, said dock workers make a good salary. The issue is whether these jobs will continue to be good jobs into the future due to automation.
As I alluded to on a previous episode, one of the things that made the longshoremen a powerful union in this country, besides their history of radicalism that never really faded away, is that they had some of these more managerial positions and supervisory positions that were not only well compensated, but also part of the union rather than being part of management. And that helped them sort of control the situation to some extent and make them more powerful. Of course, you can see that in the propaganda battles in the press that the management tries to spin that as, well, look how rich these union guys are, when, of course, most of them were not making those kind of salaries. But it's interesting to note that, in light of our previous discussion about what it would take to have sort of a powerful labor union and get some of those logistical positions that are not, you know, they're not the guys that are unloading or loading the cargo in the ports, but they're the guys that are signing off on all the paperwork for it. They're, you know, supervising those actions, etc. If you have them as part of the union rather than as part of management, that does change the dynamic, I think. Kelly, this did not resolve itself right away, this incident. Yes, they used the Taft-Hartley injunction to end this particular lockout, but as we alluded to earlier, there were broader things at stake here, not just work safety issues, not just compensation issues, but these broader questions around automation and things like that. Could you talk about how some of this conflict continued past the 2002 lockout?
Yeah, absolutely. So when this contract was signed in 2002, the union did agree to new technology, which they thought would eliminate up to 2/3 of the 600 longshore clerk jobs that Rachel talked about. But the contract did ensure that those individuals who currently held those positions would be able to keep their jobs until they chose to retire. There just wouldn't be new folks hired into that job as automation took over, which I thought was really interesting. And I wanted to know, like, what happened. So I started reading and realized that there were very similar solutions in 2008 and 2015 as the longshore contracts came to an end and had to be renegotiated. There were some extremely similar themes in both of these. One is that, again, the negotiation troubles were largely over automation and fear that people were going to lose their well-paying union jobs. Two, there was this like slowdown versus lockout conversation again, where the union was once again accused of a slowdown on each of these occasions. And the Taft-Hartley Act wasn't invoked in either of these situations, but I think it just goes to show that the reason for the dispute in 2002 even lingers, 20 years later today, as the questions about automation and what it means for labor, still persist.
So as you've emphasized here, and as the contemporary articles at the time emphasized, this debate really was more about automation than any specific questions in 2002 alone, right? This was a broader question that has been a feature of capitalism from the beginning. And of course, something that we obviously hear quite a bit thrown around is, of course, the Luddite clashes in England in the early Industrial Revolution and the sort of proto-industrial period, as workshops, cottage industry type workshops, were being replaced by the very early factory processes, where you could make more of whatever widget you were making or finished good you were making with a smaller number of workers. That wasn't automation in the sense of like robot arms manufacturing something or moving around containers by themselves, but it was mechanization, which is of course the forerunner of automation. And again, if that is sort of the whole premise around capitalism, is that the people with the capital investment money take that money and they reduce their labor costs over time by replacing workers with either by replacing workers with mechanized or automated equipment, or by getting higher profits out of each worker by allowing them to do more. We will have an episode at some point later this year about the role of the cotton gin, which of course people are very familiar with in terms of how that was an example of mechanization where the slave workers, their productivity per worker and therefore their profits per worker were dramatically increased because of that. And we'll talk more about that on that specific episode. But just to kind of give you a sense of how long of a process this has been, this is something that, of course, various Marxian economics people and Karl Marx himself talked a lot about during the 19th century, was this idea that necessarily, in order to beat out the competition and get a little bit more profits here and there, there's always going to be this pressure by the people who own the factories, own the companies, own the means of production, and have those capital resources accumulated. They're going to invest that money that they've built up from their profits to try to maintain that high level of profits. As competition drives down the profits and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall and so forth, one of the ways of avoiding that problem is to try to get more productivity per worker or to eliminate the number of workers and do the same work with fewer number of workers. So this is something that is obviously a core feature of capitalism and makes sense for us to talk about on this show as we go through the sort of industrial development and political economic development of the United States and its predecessors. And this shows that this remains a very active concern into the 21st century. And of course, we're going to continue to hear more and more about it. And we periodically hear these debates as well, which is this question is, what do you do about the fact that, you know, mechanization is coming to jobs that aren't mechanized, automation is coming to jobs that aren't already automated? And that's going to be an increasing challenge with a lot of different jobs that had previously been relatively secure. One of the things we've, of course, talked about a lot on this show is these clerical jobs, these paperwork jobs, white-collar jobs. And for a long time, many of those were seen as relatively secure positions. But increasingly, you know, after we got past the boom of adding a whole bunch of productivity per white-collar worker by computerization, we then see that we start getting to a point where the technologies can actually start to replace some of these jobs themselves. And we certainly see this, as Kelly just said, emerging in this 2002 dispute with the West Coast ports lockout, is that it wasn't just a question of the workers who were actually down on the docks moving stuff around. It was also some of these clerical positions, these white-collar managerial positions that were being automated out of existence. In some cases, you know, just having a new software package can be enough to eliminate certain job functions. We've, of course, seen that there's, you know, another alternative to that that many companies have embraced, which is offshoring the white-collar jobs to places like India, where you have a workforce that speaks and reads English and is tech savvy and can do certain jobs, you know, whether it's computer programming or even, you know, legal document work for law firms. That is a way of saving money as well. But the trend over time is going to be more toward the automation of the processes and the replacement of people with equipment. So again, the question is, what do you do about that fact? And if you're a sort of more conservative economist or economist who doesn't really buy into any of the, you know, Marxian or other leftist economic theories, your answer is always to sort of hand wave it all away and say, well, it's okay because, you know, the new reduction in labor costs will allow the company to reduce its prices to outcompete its various competitor companies. And then that will drive the prices down, so the consumer goods will go down and services costs will go down. And so even though a bunch of people lost their jobs, macroeconomically, the economy will grow and people's cost of living will go down. And of course, that's like a huge feature of a lot of the stuff that we talk about with the second industrial revolution is, oh, look at what a great new consumer economy we have with increased access to various goods and services that had previously been off limits because now the cost of living is so much less. But of course, if you are actually one of the people that is affected by this, you can see why that's not necessarily a very persuasive argument. Again, to go back to the Luddite example, which of course is commonly misunderstood in the sort of colloquial parlance, but if you understand sort of the history of that, the people weren't just breaking the machines because they were anti-technology. They were breaking the machines because they realized that not everyone was going to get rehired in these new factories who had previously been a, you know, craft worker on this particular, you know, textile production or whatever it might be at a given workshop. The people who had been doing the workshop work, you're never going to get as many people hired. That's part of the reason that you're replacing people with mechanized equipment or automated equipment. This is going to be the natural tendency. And yes, maybe the prices will come down over time, but that doesn't really fix the problem. And of course, that lies at the heart of the sort of capitalist crisis in the United States, and of course the rest of the world, but especially the United States since the 1970s or so, is that gradually more and more people are losing their jobs, and we're trying to just paper that over by saying, well, the cost of TVs went down over the time period, and, you know, people found out that they could get access to credit more easily, borrow money, use credit cards more liberally than they had in the past, or maybe they found out that they could actually lean on friends and family to get by, or maybe they'll work some odd jobs here and there and so forth. But when you have a powerful union like the longshoremen in 2002, they can look at the situation and say, all right, we need a better answer than that. We can't just muddle along. We need to actually come up with something. Now, they're not a overwhelmingly powerful union, so they were having to settle for these measures that we see here, like saying that, you know, we're going to phase out workers through attrition so they don't all lose their jobs immediately. They get to retirement age and then they're gone. And that's sort of a redundancy phase. And of course, the companies don't like that because that means that they're not immediately recouping the costs of their investment in these capital upgrades. But it is one sort of short-term solution. But it doesn't really solve the overall long-term problem here, which is that gradually more and more jobs are getting automated away, and we need a solution for that. And then again, the question is, what do you do about that? So the sort of left-wing solution, you know, in an ideal world is that you have the workers owning in the means of production themselves, benefiting from any of the, it wouldn't be profits in this case, but whatever the surplus is that you are recouping. And then you could say, okay, this is the amount of money that will be generated from, you know, savings on labor costs or additional productivity per worker if we mechanize this process or if we automate this process, and the people that get laid off as a result or no longer need to work, we're going to pay them using this additional money or something like that, right? That would be one potential solution. But that's not the society that we live in, right? This isn't a communist economy or even a state capitalist left-wing economy. So you have to figure out some other solution. So Rachel, I'll go back to you at this point. Now that we've kind of had this overarching discussion, what are your thoughts on this sort of dispute that happened in 2002 and the broader question around automation and what to do about it?
Well, one aspect that I kind of wanted to touch on is how the Pacific Maritime Association, which did represent these shipping lines and terminal operators, basically wielded the government as a weapon against the union. So I think that's something that we'll have to look at in the future, especially because everyone was focused on the Iraq War resolution. The PMA were kind of able to sneakily do this. And I, just given how turbulent things are right now and how you can kind of see the drumbeat of war against Iran kind of building up, I kind of wonder if we'll use that kind of uncertainty and need to potentially move things quickly over shipping lines or whatever to maybe kind of weaken labor again in the future or other industries that are involved with supply chains or what have you.
Right. I mean, it goes to show the inextricable link between the imperial project overseas and the damage to the unions at home, right? This is no, you know, we saw this in World War II as well, but of course in World War II you say, well, okay, yes, we've restricted the unions from striking and put various other restrictions on labor action, but in exchange for that, you're going to get all these new jobs as a result of defense production. But again, that's not really the case when you're talking about the modern defense industry. And that's something that we actually talked about on the show with the interview that Nate and I did with Lily Geismer and her book, Don't Blame Us, talking about the suburbanization of the Democratic Party from the end of the 1960s onward, and looking at sort of the defense industry, not in the production side, but in terms of those really high-end, highly compensated white-collar workers doing the design work and things like that, the technical engineering work. But increasingly, the defense industry has moved away from We've got all these, you know, great factory jobs for everyone, in favor instead of these more limited number of white collar jobs, and then a bunch of executives getting paid, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation packages. How have they done that? Same thing as all these other industries, which is that they mechanized and automated the process. In this case, we're seeing in 2002 the Taft-Hartley Act being invoked explicitly or almost explicitly under the premise, at least as interpreted by the New York Times at the time, that, oh, we might need, you know, maximum shipping capacity, free of interruptions, to be able to move material back and forth from the U.S. to the Persian Gulf, because we're probably going to go to war with Iraq. There was such a long buildup to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and they weren't sure how long it was going to take between the Iraq War resolution and the actual invasion in March of the next year, that they thought, you know, this could be happening any day. So we gotta end this right away. So you can't separate these two projects from each other. Kelly, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think to touch on something that you've mentioned a couple of times, something that caught my eye while reading these articles were these statements like, these clerks make $119,000. And I felt like sort of the writing between the lines there was like, what else could they want? What else could they possibly ask for? Like, these people are making six figures. And so I just think, as we think about automation, it's like, why is the assumption that the owner gets to keep the difference, that the owner gets to keep the increased revenue? Why can't we find a place? I mean, automation is here. It's not going anywhere. But how do we make it such that everyone can benefit from it and not just the owner of a company or a port? And I think it's disturbing, quite honestly, how little we question that, who gets to keep their profit. So that's something that I often notice when reading about union contract negotiations, whether it be teachers or longshoremen or anyone else. Like, they make X amount of money. How could they want anything more? Even though automation should be about giving more to everyone with less work, ideally.
That's exactly right, Kelly. And that goes back to the same thing that we talked about last week on our Taft-Hartley episode, which is the, you know, go back to the basics, 19th century Marxist economics. You have, for every dollar that is generated over, you know, how whatever your time period is, by a company, by the economic activity of a company, that the dollar that is generated through, you know, the ultimately selling some good or service at the end of the line, but that's being generated each minute, each hour, by the, whether it's the production on the factory or the loading and unloading of ships in this case and so forth. You can divide that value into two parts. You have the wage part, which goes to the worker, and you have the profit part, which goes to the company. And it's always a tug of war under the capitalist system, or even under a social democratic system, where you haven't replaced market capitalism. It's always a tug of war between how big of a ratio of each dollar is going to wages versus going to profits to the company. And I think, like, it's common to use that phrase, profit sharing, which you've just used, Kelly. But I think if we want to be really technical, it's not really a question of profit sharing per se, because profit is whatever the surplus is beyond the, you know, the wage costs and the production costs and any the inputs, basically, which includes labor, but also includes whatever machinery you needed and things like that. It's not really profit sharing if you're giving it back to the workers, because that would be technically just really increasing their wages. But it is a fair question to be asking, which is that, you know, if you are increasing the number of dollars that are being generated over a time period or per worker, you are changing the balance there. And if you are reserving all of those gains to the ownership class, the people that own the company, then you have increased the profits and you have not increased the wages. You have not changed that ratio. And those are the people that, of course, are being hit harder. But, you know, as I said last week, when you're looking at something, even if it's a highly compensated job, like a white collar clerical worker that is managing paperwork and logistics around unloading and loading cargo, and you say, well, this person's making well over $100,000 in 2002. What more could they want? Again, divide that by the number of hours that they're working in the course of a year, and then compare that to the amount of money that the company is making per hour from their activity. Because in the past, we've, of course, talked about, and kind of derisively in some cases, you know, how many jobs in the economy today, especially after the computerization era began, are just like these spreadsheet jobs where you're just moving around numbers on a spreadsheet. And that's not necessarily like, you know, it doesn't necessarily seem like a particularly valuable job to society or whatever. And it may not even feel particularly fulfilling. But again, in this case, you're talking about moving around enormous amounts of cargo worth enormous amounts of money. I guarantee you that these companies were making money hand over fist. You know, even if they're only making somehow several hundred dollars per hour per one of these clerical workers, if the clerical worker is only making less than $100 an hour in terms of their salary, that still means that the company is generating enormous profits out of each dollar of value being generated by this worker relative to the amount of money that the worker is taking home. And I think that's important to emphasize. Like, that's a very basic premise, but that is important to emphasize because people don't necessarily think of it that way. It's the same thing that we see, like, right now there's another one of these debates going around about $15 minimum wage and so forth, and you get all the anti-minimum wage people and anti-minimum wage increase people saying, you know, that McDonald's or whoever is going to automate all of these jobs, which is pretty silly because, you know, they have not actually taught robots how to do most of the work at McDonald's. That there's certain functions that you can add a machine to help out with in terms of ordering or whatever, but a lot of the jobs are still going to be humans for at least a while longer. But regardless, if you assume that it is true that automation is coming over time to McDonald's, that will be happening regardless of whether or not the labor costs go up significantly. And you could say, well, maybe it's going to happen much faster, but that's not necessarily true. It's also not really a good argument because it doesn't actually answer the question, the overall broader question about what do you do about this automation tendency. This is a tendency. Just as it is a tendency for the rate of profit to fall, it's a tendency for the capitalist owners to try to replace labor costs with various non-labor cost inputs that are cheaper over time. When you work in a service job, whether it's McDonald's or whether it's a bartender or whatever, it's much easier to see the relationship in a way that is more abstract when we're talking about clerks in 2002 at a port in California or Oregon or Washington, in terms of the relationship between how much value you're generating for the company each hour versus how much money they are making off of the value that you've generated, and what that ratio is between the share of the value they're getting and the share of the value you are getting as the worker. If you, you know, are working at a restaurant or working at a bar and you sell a burger for, you know, whether it's a, you know, cheap burger on the low end for $2 or something and you're selling a high volume per hour, or whether you're selling $10 or $15 gourmet burgers and you're selling several of those an hour, if you are making $7.25 an hour and you sell a $15 burger, then that is already generated basically, you know, twice the amount almost that you made during that hour. And that's before you add in all of the drinks that you also sold during that hour, all of the other meals that you prepared during that hour. Again, some of this is just me restating very basic things that most people will have already realized, but I do think it is worth stating again for the record, because this premise also applies when we're talking about enormous volumes of cargo being unloaded at enormous profits for these companies in 2002 in the ports. It's the same exact principle. In this case, you're talking about generating hundreds of dollars of value or thousands of dollars of value an hour per worker, but the worker is still not getting compensated at even half of what is being generated by the work that they're doing. And again, I think that is worth restating and reemphasizing at any level of production in this. Yes, it gets a little bit more complicated, as we've talked about before, if you start getting into higher level executive positions that are getting a significant amount of compensation through stock options and things like that, because even if they aren't, you know, people who have a decisive role in the company's direction as stock owners because they own relatively small share, it is true that their salary depends on the success, quote unquote, of the company and the profit increases of the company and the, you know, how, what the quarterly returns are, what the shareholder payouts are, what the share prices are based on investor, major institutional investors' confidence in the direction of the company's share price as a place to park their money. All of that does affect your compensation, so that gets a little bit more complicated. But if you're talking about somebody that's working a salary job and they're making, you know, it's a mostly through pure salary, relatively nominal amounts in stock compensation, it is on a larger, grander scale, the same thing that's happening at a bar down the street, the same thing that's happening at the McDonald's near you. All of this is the same principle, whether or not they're making significant amounts of money. And it becomes, again, more important to look at what role they play within the company and that sort of thing. But we don't have very good class consciousness in this country, or really almost any at all. So a lot of people have trouble visualizing and understanding some of these relationships. Closing thoughts from either of you on this.
Yeah, I would just add something else that helps me as I think about automation is, you know, the company is paying you to do a certain amount of work and has decided it has value, which is why they're paying you. And if, so if you're a clerk processing invoices, and now because of the software, you're able to process twice as many invoices, you've become twice as productive for the company. Having that reflected in your paycheck is what I advocate for.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with Kelly. Like, we have seen productivity rise exponentially in the past few decades, and worker compensation flatlining or even going down due to inflation. So I definitely think we need to talk about this more, and also talk about the non-money things that, that unions fight for, just having more democratic power in the company and being able to change and affect the direction the company goes in through the collective bargaining of the union. So I think that's something that really gets lost in the messaging.
I think the other thing to notice here is, again, this does encapsulate sort of, as Rachel just alluded to, with regard to the relationship between compensation flatlining over time and worker productivity and the value generated from that increasing over the past 50 years at this point, quite dramatically, is that the monopoly consolidations that we saw in the Second Industrial Revolution, this process continuing a century later in the 1980s and just continuing to accelerate year after year, decade after decade over the past 40 and 50 years, is that it's the same exact stuff that the Marxian economists and Marx himself were talking about in the 19th century, even before that process had started to happen in the case of the Second Industrial Revolution or fully been realized. They were able to identify all of these tendencies in place. It is not just a question of gradually, you know, certain jobs will be mechanized away or automated away. It is not just a question that the, you know, the profits will fall and therefore these companies will desperately reach out to try to do anything to reduce their costs so they can, you know, get their profits to maintain stability and then find themselves in the, back in the same position and having to repeat the process over and over again. It is that cycle is compounding, right? The less money that has been set aside for the workers as productivity has increased means more profits flowing to these companies that are able to make these changes, mechanizations and automations first, which means that they are able to faster drive out their competition and outcompete, you know, whoever gets there first generally is going to do better and be able to attain market dominance. And this is the consolidation process that means that the companies will necessarily, without some kind of dramatic intervention by an external force like the government, they will necessarily continue to consolidate and they will continue to get wealthier and wealthier. And the more wealth that they generate through these changes that they're making and not giving this money back to the workers, not creating funds for the laid off workers, means that they will be able to do it again faster the next time there is an improvement in the technology. That's the process that we've seen over the past 40, 50 years, is that the American companies that are doing this, they are continuing to get richer and richer and richer and be able to make these adjustments faster and faster to be able to cut even more workers and continue to reap the rewards. This is an iterative process that is compounding the situation unless there is a significant intervention, unless they are forced and compelled by either the government or powerful unions to divert some of this increased value that is generated back into the workers in the form of higher wages and compensation and other benefits and things like that. So that is an important thing to understand about this. If you do not step in and intervene on this, it is only going to continue to get worse, because that is the process of consolidation, which is, again, one of the reasons why we've been talking so much about the Second Industrial Revolution on this show, is we want people to understand that, unlike, say, the First Industrial Revolution, although you can see bits and pieces of that starting to emerge at the local level, the processes and trends that we're seeing now and will continue to see over the coming decades are the same exact ones that we saw with those the early emergence of those first monopolies in the American economy in the post-Civil War period. This is the same exact process. This is the same exact economy. Yes, there are some changes that have happened since then, and there's a lot of financialization stuff that takes these things in a completely new and other direction that didn't exist at the time. But for the most part, you can pick out what the trends were from the post-Civil War period in the economy, and you can find, if not the exact same thing, you can find the analog to it that is the same, essentially the same process playing itself out. Rachel, thank you so much for being on this week.
Glad to be here.
And Kelly, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
As a reminder, this is our free episode, and the episode, the bonus episodes will be out at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy. In the case of the free episodes like this one, our links and notes will be up, as always, at a PDF at arsenalfordemocracy.com. Thanks for listening.